Everybody, so again, I want to just finish the listing of the seven B'nai Noach, Mitzvot B'nai Noach, and when they differ from the laws that apply to us as Jewish people. I think we ended off yesterday with murder, Shvichus Damim, and I had mentioned the treatment of abortion is actually an interesting difference between Noahide law, so to speak, and the halacha that applies to Jews. We then come to, we did Avodah Zarah, we did blasphemy, we did murder. Then we have Gilui Arayos, sexual offenses. And here, there obviously is an overlap. Adultery is a violation of both the Noahide law and Halacha. Homosexuality is Nichlal, homosexual, you know, sex is Nichlal in the Isser of Arayos. However, here, there are certain arayos that are prohibited for Jews that are actually permitted for B'nai Noach. Among them is, you know, the Torah does allow polygamy. The Torah itself does allow a man to have more than one wife, but you're not allowed to marry two sisters. There's an iser for a Jew to marry two sisters, and even if you divorce one sister, you cannot marry the other sister. You can only marry the other sister when the first sister dies. This is an erva of Achos Isha. For B'nai Noach, there is no erva called Achos Isha. This gives rise to a very interesting question, a big, big debate. Yaakov, of course, did marry two sisters. Here's the question. Before the Torah was given, the Jewish people were bound by the Noahide laws. Under the Noahide laws, there is no problem in marrying two sisters, so everything is great. However, we have a rabbinic tradition. We have a Masorah of Chazal that although the Torah was not given yet, the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, through their Ruach HaKodesh, voluntarily kept the whole Torah before it was given. So remember the idea here. They had to keep the Noahide laws because it's before the Torah was given. But on a volunteer basis, based on their Ruach HaKodesh, they did keep the Torah laws as well. So that creates the question, how could Yaakov marry two sisters, since even if under the Noahide law it was permitted, but the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, kept the whole Torah. So there are a lot of answers here. One is a very famous answer of the Ramban. The Ramban gives a teretz that because the keeping of the Torah was a volunteer basis, it was not an obligation, they only kept the Torah when they were living in the land of Israel because of the closeness to Hashem. So even though the Isra of Arayas has nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael, you got to keep Arayas even outside of Eretz Yisrael, but they weren't obligated. All of this was a volunteer idea. So the volunteerism, the Ramban writes, only applies in the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. It did not apply outside. Now, that's not a complete answer. So when Yaakov married Rachel and Leah, he was in Chutz La'aretz, in Lavan's house. So it's kind of a grandfathered in. So when you come back to Eretz Yisrael, you're allowed to stay married. But indeed, the Ramban suggests that that might be spiritually why Rachel died shortly after they came back to Eretz Yisrael. Because once they're in Eretz Yisrael, Yaakov is not supposed to be married to two sisters, right? Rachel dies shortly after their return. Okay, this is an answer of the Ramban. The Maharal doesn't like that answer. The Maharal basically says, hey, this isn't Truma or Shemitah. I mean, those are mitzvahs that are different in Israel and Chutz La'aretz. This is something that should apply everywhere. So where do you see a distinction that arayos are going to be practiced, the laws of arayos will be observed in Eretz Yisrael and not in Chutz Laaretz. So the Maharal suggests another answer, a very, very fascinating answer. You know, we have a rule about conversion that when a person is non-Jewish and they become Jewish, they are treated like a newly created entity. Have you ever heard that idea? That when you're a ger, it's like you're newly created? You know what that means, amazingly enough? That means under Torah law, rabbinically it's forbidden, under Torah law, if a father and a daughter convert. Now, as a geneticist would not advise this, but if a father and a daughter convert, they can marry. A mother can marry her son. A brother can marry his sister. Now, rabbinically, it's forbidden because it's, Marasayan, it looks bad, etc. But under Torah law, it's permitted based on the principle that conversion erases all pre-existing connections. So Maral's answer is, Rachel and Leah, when they joined Yaakov's family, they converted, so to speak, to the monotheistic religion. It's hard to say Judaism because there wasn't really Judaism yet. But they converted to the religion of Yaakov, faith in Hashem. So as a result, it erased their relationship as sisters. So therefore, you could marry them, right? That's what the Maral says. So be it as it may, as I indicated, this is not lahalacha. In other words, rabbinically, it is absolutely forbidden to do it. But on a Torah level, it would be permitted. Right? That's arayas. It is important to know, though, and this is very relevant in modern law, that homosexuality. Actually, I shouldn't say homosexuality. It's not the desire for the same sex, but the practice of homosexual sexual relations, in whatever way, is prohibited not only for Jews based on Chumash Vayikra, but it is prohibited under the Noahide law, and therefore any legitimation of gay marriage or the like would in fact be usher. Not only that, there's a very fascinating Gemara. You know, Sodom, we're going to read next week that the city of Sodom gets destroyed. And they get destroyed. Now, the Torah doesn't say exactly what is so bad about Sodom. It just says they are evil and sinners. It doesn't really say what their sin is. And there are different interpretations. Some say their sin is their cruelty to the strangers. They would never give hospitality. They would never give charity. They just were selfish because of their prosperity. Others say that the sin of Sodom was what we call sodomy. That's where they got the word, that they openly practiced homosexual perversions. You see that a little bit because when the angels are Lot's guests, the city of Sodom surrounds the house and says, "Give us those men so we may know them." Know them is a euphemism for that. Now, the Gemara then says an amazing statement. This is really amazing because it's scary. Sodom was not destroyed because they practiced sodomy. Sodom was destroyed because they wrote a kesuvah for it. By that we mean, if they were just doing it as a sin, that's pretty bad. It's a very bad sin. But what's worse is when you take the sin and you make it into something good. In other words, they made a marriage ceremony. What is writing a ketubah? They made a marriage ceremony out of it. Wow, this is really almost like a prophetic Maimer Chazal. It's not the sin. I mean, the sin is bad, of course. But it's not the sin that's so bad as it is turning the sin and making it into a mitzvah. You know, I actually saw, maybe I shouldn't even mention it, I actually saw a little video. I mean, mamish, it can make you very, very, very sick. About two men who were getting married, I shouldn't say married, under a chuppah with a talis and with sheva brachos being recited. Now, you understand, that's much worse than two men just fooling around by themselves. Two men fooling around by themselves, it's an aveira, yetzer hara. But here, you're trying to say, it's not that I'm sinning. I'm doing Kedusha. I'm doing something holy. That's much, much worse. That's a perversion. And that's exactly what the Gemara says. Okay. Maybe some other time, I think we have questions and answers today, we can talk about And again, I don't mean to make light of this. I mean, there are genuinely religious Jews that have homosexual attractions. And that is a serious issue that deserves compassion, and one needs to know how to do it, what to do with it. But the one thing you can't say is you can't just say, it's mutter. That you can't do. We have to figure out what you could say, which is much more difficult. But, yeah.
If that is the case that we hold, like the Gemara, that says that the fact stone is destroyed for creating the suva,
yep.
Not homosexual marriages,
yep.
then surely shouldn't that same outcome apply to, America?
1,000%. 1,000%. That's why I say it's a little scary. Lucky you're here. People say, oh, got to leave Israel, it's dangerous. Who knows, America might be more dangerous right now. Because the Supreme Court of the United States, as you know, a few months ago, it hasn't been a year yet, they just said they legitimated homosexual marriage. And they even said, legally, when they declare restricting marriage is unconstitutional, they're saying that even if a state would want to say can't have gay marriage, they don't have their rishus anymore. They must recognize. It's not, the Supreme Court didn't say they can recognize it. The Supreme Court said they must recognize it. They are chayav to recognize it. That's mamish what the Gemara is talking about. Right? So that's a difficult situation.
Where is the Gemara at?
It's a Gemara in Chulin. I can find the daf. I have to look up what's more included, and also Medrash says the same thing.
Medrash Rabbah.
You see, this is an important idea generally. In other words, it's not just homosexuality. It's an important idea that there's a difference between doing an Avera when at least I know I'm doing an Avera, and doing an Avera when I convince myself it's a mitzvah. And the latter is a more serious thing, because there, you've distorted the value system. If I do an Aveira and I know it's an Aveira, at least I recognize the values of what is good and what is bad. And sometimes I can't live up to it. I mean, all of us have things we don't live up to. I mean, I might speak Lashon Hara. I mean, there are things that we do that are not proper, but at least we have a sense that it's not proper, and then we can hopefully do tshuva. But when you convince yourself that the improper is now a good thing, very hard to do tshuva, because you actually think you're doing a good thing with brachos and chuppah. So it's not just homosexuality, it's all of those things. When you convince yourself that the bad is good, you're in much bigger trouble than if you know it's bad, but you're doing it, because your Yetzer Hara is weak, or Yetzer Hara is strong, the Yetzer Tov is weak, etc. Yeah?
I was wondering whether or not there's a distinction between writing a tshuva and what America and Canada and other countries are calling a marriage, which is really a civil ceremony that's not a Jewish marriage.
It is possible. You could say that the ksuba is making it into a religious ceremony.
I mean, when the Gemara says marriage, surely they don't mean what marriage is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Sodom were not tzaddikim, so I assume they didn't have sheva brachos and everything else. What you're saying is a possible line of distinction, and this gets rise to an interesting, very interesting political question, which has halachic ramifications, and that is, I mean, I don't want to get too contemporary, but it is an issue to ponder. And that is, there are people, politicians, that say we would never be in favor of gay marriage, okay? Because marriage is husband-wife, but we don't want to discriminate. We'll have something called, in fact, they'll sometimes use a different lexicon. They'll call it a civil union, where there could be economic division of property, there could be health insurance, coverage, hospital visitation rights. So an interesting question would be, would halacha permit us, or permit a Noahide society, let's say, would halacha permit a Noahide society not to call something marriage, but maybe to create a shutfus, a partnership for economic purposes? Possibly yes. Again, the question is that considered encouragement? Is that an imprimatur, or is that simply saying we don't want? No, the relationship is the rice, I understand, but the question is, I mean, this, when you're a government, I mean, you're not doing homosexuality. The question simply is, when are you giving a stamp of approval? When are you legitimating? That's a secondary question. I mean, I'm not saying the people who are doing civil unions are permitted to do it. No, they're not. The question is the government considered to be giving a hechsher on the practice in that type of law? So that's a bit of a different. I mean, I'll give you another example: abortion. Okay, let me give you an example. Abortion, we said, is absolutely forbidden for Noahides as well, unless the mother's life is in danger. Okay. Now let's say we have a law that says that when hospitals do abortions, there are certain sterilization safety rules that have to be followed. Right? Now, am I allowed to vote in favor of that law? Or let's say I'm a Jewish legislature. Or is my attitude, hey, you're not supposed to do abortions, so I don't care if the mother died, you know, I don't care. You know, the answer would be, you're not giving a hechsher, but if it's going to be done, you want it to be done in a way that people don't die. See what I'm saying? Not every type of connection to a forbidden practice is really a legitimation of the practice. Right? Different things like that. Okay. All right. So let's see. I don't want to lose my count here. So we talked about idolatry, avodah zarah. We talked about blasphemy. We talked about a murder. And we talked about the sexual offenses. Right? That gives us four. Okay. We did four so far. Okay, so the fifth is Eiver Min Achai. Eiver Min Achai is an interesting law that this is for Noahites. Noahites don't have to keep kosher. Noahites can eat pork and shellfish and everything else. That's why we tell a potential ger, you know, it's like just like you're on death row, we tell you get a last meal. Shouldn't call becoming a Jew like going on death row. But you know, so we tell the non-Jew, go out and have your lobster thermidor or whatever it is, because this will be the last time. So non-Jews don't have to keep kosher, but there is one kosher rule they have to keep. They cannot eat a limb that was severed from an animal while the animal was still alive. So if you took even a kosher animal, took a sheep, cut off the leg like these ancient barbarians would do, then even if the animal then dies, if the limb was cut off when the animal was alive, that is called Eiver Min Hachai, and it is usher for Jews to eat that, and it's usher for a non-Jew to eat it as well. In a more general way, you might say, if you generalize the concept, that this is a cruelty to animals type of law. Because you know it's cruelty to an animal to dismember it when it's alive. Shechita itself is very painless. We know this. There's been an old anti-Semitic accusation for hundreds and hundreds of years that the Jewish way of slaughter is cruel. That's absolutely false. In fact, it's very, very fascinating. You know who the world's greatest experts on this is? Is an autistic woman, non-Jewish, Temple Graydon is her name. And she has a PhD in animal physiology and the like, and it's amazing. Maybe because of her autism, it's almost as if she can communicate to the animals. It's just amazing. She like knows exactly what the animals are feeling. And she has said, she has studied all the different ways that animals are killed. She's really a world-famous specialist. And she concludes that Jewish ritual slaughter, severing the trachea and the esophagus with one swipe with a very sharp knife, creates an instant loss of consciousness, and there is no pain whatsoever, and there is not even fear. The one thing she said that scares animals is animals are scared when they hear or they see other animals being killed. So she designed slaughterhouses where the animals are going down narrow paths and they don't see the other animals or hear the other animals, and that makes the animals perfectly comfortable. So shechita is instant loss of consciousness, but Eiver Min Achai is prohibited. Now here, interestingly enough, although Jews and non-Jews both have this prohibition, there is a difference once again between the Jew and the non-Jew, fascinatingly. That is, with a non-Jew, once you shecht an animal, even if it's still convulsing, neurologically there'll still be electrical impulse, like a chicken without a head. Even when it's convulsing, once it is shechted, it is halachically dead. So if I shecht an animal, and it's convulsing, and I cut off its leg after I shechted it, I can eat that leg. For a non-Jew, since shechita is not relevant, as long as there's spasmodic movement, it is still alive, and there is an Isser of Ezer Menachai. So the commonality is they both have the laws of Ezer Menachai, but with a Jew, a mifarcheses. Mifarcheses means a spasmodic animal is considered dead after Shechita. That can cut off the limb. But in the case of a non-Jew, it is considered to be alive until the spasmodic movement has stopped. Yeah.
Is there any specifications on the way to kill an animal for a non-Jew?
No, there is not. There is not. The animal can be killed anyway, including a gunshot or whatever.
So
whatever
they
it is.
Cut off the leg and then kill the animal and then eat the leg?
No. The reason that's not going to work is that Ezer Menachai says if the leg was severed when the animal was alive, even if the animal then gets killed, you can't eat that leg. In other words, it's not only while the animal's alive. So if it was severed first, you could not eat it. And that's true for a Jew as well. If I severed the leg before Shechita, and then I shechted the animal, it would not be able to eat. Now, 6 and 7. 6, again, these are no particular order. Yeah.
What is the Kabbalistic reason why we don't eat from the animal that's still alive?
Well, okay, I mean, there's not a single Kabbalistic reason. But the concept is basically this. You know that Jews cannot eat blood even, right? Now the Torah says, why don't we eat blood? Because blood is the seat of life, or the life force. And therefore it is wrong for us. The life force is the godliness in the creature. And therefore we have to give it to God. We're not allowed to take it for ourselves. We can only take the inert matter. So if that's so even for blood, then certainly while the animal is actually alive, it's as if to say on some level there's a certain godly force within the animal. We are not allowed to appropriate that for ourselves. We have to wait until it's matter, so to speak. It's connected to that. It's connected to the blood prohibition, although non-Jews don't have the blood prohibition per se. But non-Jews do have the more vital Ezer Menachai idea. Now the sixth one is gezel, theft. Not allowed to steal. Jews aren't allowed to steal. Non-Jews are not allowed to steal. There is an issur of gezel. Now gezel, for Jews and for non-Jews, let me point out, it's important for us to know as well, is much broader than you might think. It doesn't only refer to, you know, I stole your car, but it refers to borrowing things without permission. That is a form of theft. It refers to cheating people in business. That is a form of theft. It refers to misrepresentation. I sell you a car and I don't tell you that the brakes are bad. Or someone sent me a shiloh this morning where they're doing something through Amazon and they're selling products that are advertised as new, which turn out to be used. And if people aren't happy, they'll just send it back. So anything wrong with that? I mean, you know, I send you, you order a new watch, I send you a watch that's scratched. You know, so if you're happy, you'll keep it. If you're not happy, yeah, you won't keep it. Send it back. Cancel. Well, once again, that's absolutely forbidden. I mean, you're not allowed to misrepresent what you're selling, even if the person can reverse the transaction. It's a big schlep to reverse transactions and everything else. So theft can also mean using office supplies without permission. It can refer to playing solitaire during business hours if you're being paid to work. So one has to keep in mind, theft is a real big category that goes beyond just literally stealing something. It does apply to Jews and non-Jews. I'll come back to this later. Now the seventh one is really the most interesting and the most complicated. Yeah?
Can I ask a question about the borrowing?
Yeah.
What if you borrowed something knowing that if the person was there, they would say yes?
Yeah, that's a different situation. I'll give you an example that's brought down the halacha. Let's say I come late to davening and I forgot my tefillin. I left my tefillin in Har Nof. Let's say I live in Har Nof. I don't have a pair of tefillin. But I see your tefillin are on the table there, but you're not here. If it's the regular davening, I certainly can't take your tefillin because you're going to need it. Right? I can't. You know, I can't come in and use your tefillin. But you've already davened. So am I allowed to wear your talis, wear your tefillin, can I use your sfarim, etc.? So there is a klal in halacha that since people are normally happy that others should use their property for a mitzvah, we assume, unless it says specifically, don't touch, and you can write, you have the right to say that, but unless it says don't touch, don't use, we assume that if I would ask you, you were to say, you would say yes. So it doesn't only apply to mitzvah, it can apply to other things as well, that if you know, now you have to know, if you know that they wouldn't mind and they would even be happy, then you're not called a thief. But if you don't know, you've got to be strict. This is called Shoel Shalom Midas. One who borrows without permission, without authorization, is called a gozlan. By the way, there's an interesting consequence here. When you're a gozlan, two things happen. Number one, you're guilty of a very serious aveira. That's true. But number two, there's another corollary there. A gozlan is responsible if anything happens to the item, even if it's beyond his control. So, for example, if I borrowed your laptop without your permission, etc. And then what happened was there was an earthquake, and the laptop, you know, fell off a table and broke. It's not my fault. I didn't do anything wrong. But once I become a thief, I am absolutely liable for whatever happens to that object. I have to pay you the replacement value of that laptop. So being a gozlan can also hit you, you know, in your pocketbook, because you can't just give back a broken computer. You have to give back Actually, it's interesting. How you compute damages is complicated. You don't have to give him. I misspoke a second ago. You don't have to give him replacement value because that would be a new computer. You give him let's say if the laptop is 3 years old, you give him what a 3-year-old computer is worth. And so even though he's going to want to get a new one, you don't have to give him the money for a new one. You have to give him the value of the laptop as you look at an auction or whatever it would be. So that's an interesting point to keep in mind, that halacha does not require that you pay the value of new goods when you destroyed old goods. Alike. Okay. Now the seventh one is very, very interesting and actually very, very complex. The seventh one is generically called dinim, laws. What are laws? I mean, everything was laws. The other six are laws too. So here there's a big machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides. According to the Rambam, dinim is a commandment that God gives non-Jewish societies, a commandment to set up a court system to enforce and to punish the other six laws. Okay, we have six laws. Don't steal, don't kill, don't do all of these things. The seventh law says every non-Jewish society must set up a court system to punish the violations of the other Noahide laws. And any society that does not punish wrongdoing, the society as a whole is violating the seventh commandment of Noah. Now, you're going to see this is going to have very, very strange repercussions. This is Rambam. This is Rambam's view. Ramban agrees with the Rambam that you got to do that, but he says it's much more than that. Dinim is HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling Noahide societies, I've given you six minimum requirements, but you have a mitzvah to pass other laws to make society better. It might be minimum wage laws, environmental laws, health laws. In other words, God is essentially telling the Noahide society, I've given you the basics, which you must have, and then I am commanding you to make other laws that will make society better. So God is not saying if income tax should be a progressive or flat tax. That's left to the society. But they are given essentially, what is God essentially telling them? Create a more just society. This is quite amazing. This is a very rare example of Hashem giving a mitzvah whose implementation will depend on the political judgment of a moral society. Meaning, unlike the Jews, for which God kind of gives us all the rules, although that's not entirely true either, here God is saying non-Jews can make different types of rules if they want. They can make the minimum wage, you know, $10 an hour, they can make it $7.50. But they're obligated to try to create a more fair and a more just society. Now, what that means is the following. That means that if non-Jews pass a law, it now becomes God's command, because God is commanding. In fact, that is the source. That is actually, Rashi says in Maseches Gittin, a fascinating thing. He connects two things that you wouldn't connect. You've heard the rule, I'm sure, of the Gemara, of Shmuel, Dina de Malchusa Dina. That means the law of the civil, secular law of the land is the law of the land, meaning I am obligated religiously to obey the secular laws if they don't contradict the Torah. Now, the question is, the Gemara doesn't say why. Why am I obligated to obey the law of the land? I mean, if I could evade taxes and get away with it, why shouldn't I? What sin am I committing? Rashi says in Maseches Gittin, you know what sin you're committing? Since Bnei Noach were commanded to make these laws, so any laws they make that are fair and just become Hashem's commandment. And therefore you have to keep them. Now you see a chiddush according to Rashi, that the notion that Bnei Noach were given this authority to make laws even applies to the Jews. In other words, it doesn't only apply to the other non-Jews, it even applies to the Jews. Of course, it's interesting, according to Rashi, you can raise this question, I'll continue this next week as well. If the reason why I got to obey secular law is because Bnei Noach were given the power to make these laws, do I have to obey secular law in the state of Israel? In other words, I have to obey secular law in the United States, because the United States is a non-Jewish country. They have the seventh commandment of Noah. They're given this power to pass these laws. So I got to obey it. That's what Rashi says. But in the Eretz Yisrael, which is a Jewish state, right? Maybe they're not covered by the Noahide law. So there actually is an opinion, which you might hear in the religious world. I don't endorse it. Rabbi Yashiv didn't endorse it. That you do not have to obey, that even if you have to obey the civil law in the United States or a non-Jewish country, you do not have to obey the secular law in a Jewish state like Israel, because they don't have that Noahide empowerment. Rebbe Yashiv disagreed, and again, if anyone would ask me, I would tell you, be law-abiding, but that's why some people do have a heter, they feel, not to pay Israeli taxes, or whatever. At least in Lumbus, you could see where they're coming from. Now, I'll tell you a story, though, that in this country, tax evasion is unfortunately so prevalent. There was a fellow, a very sincere person. He was a Baal Tshuva, and he became a Sofer. And Soferim are usually paid in cash. Now, to write a Sefer Torah is a lot of money. You write a Sefer Torah, you get $25,000. So he, this might be the only recorded case in history, he said, oh, I owe 15% or 30% of this in taxes. So he took $25,000 to the tax office, the treasury, and he said, I want to know what my taxes are on this cash. So the guy behind the desk looked at him. He didn't understand what he wanted. What do you want? He says, I want to pay my taxes. He says, what? And he just said, get out of here, you're just nuts. The guy refused. He says, you know, it would have been so much trouble to try to figure out the taxes, and no one ever did it before. You know, he just said, go home. But as I say, Rebbe Yashiv said, it's important to be honest, especially in a Jewish society where if a religious Jew is not honest, you desecrate God's name. But in Lumdus, at least, there is a basis that Eretz Yisrael, you would not have to follow the civil law. Okay. So this is the big machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban.
So just with regards to the mitzvah, is the onus on the legislators or on the society as a whole?
Okay, so it seems to be an obligation on society to create those forms of government that will then try to make society more just. Now, the legislators are deemed to be agents, emissaries, and shluchim of society. If they fail to do their job, then the Noahide society has an obligation to replace them. Now, it's very difficult to translate that to an individual sin on one person. I mean, I can't replace a government, but collectively, God considers the society responsible.
Two questions. The first one, in terms of making laws, are they allowed to make laws like death penalty?
Okay, so I'm going to talk about that because I've been avoiding penalty issues. The real question is the opposite of what you ask, because the violation of Noahide laws carries with it the death penalty. The question is, are they allowed not to have a death penalty? And that's going to be a very, because I'll talk about that next one. This is a very, very important question. Is the death penalty mandatory? Is it discretionary? Can it ever be outlawed? We'll talk about that. And I'm also going to talk about next time, which I alluded to a little bit, vigilantism in the enforcement of Noahide law. Meaning, if I see a non-Jew violating Noahide law, am I allowed to take the law into my own hands? The Rambam suggests yes, and we'll see exactly the different opinions. So I know we're a little off the parsha, but we'll get readjusted. But I want to cover this area because a lot of times people are not so familiar with it. Yeah?
Earlier on, when we were discussing Aran,
Doraisa.
You were saying like the different family members can marry each other.
Doraisa, yeah.
Yeah, but you said according to Torah, then you said rabbinic law overrules that. But
yes.
Surely Torah takes preference over rabbinic law.
No, we understand that. Of course, that's the case. But remember that one of the things the rabbis always do is that they prohibit to make a fence around the Torah. Now, you understand what's going on here. If this brother and sister can marry because they're converted, people might erroneously think any brother and sister can marry. So this is a classic example where the Torah permits, doesn't require, it permits, and the rabbis to make a fence around the Torah. Add a prohibition. That is something the rabbis have the power to do. That's making a fence around the Torah. Just like everything. For example, the Torah prohibits meat and milk. Chicken and milk is permitted. Fowl and milk. And yet the rabbis prohibited the chicken lest you come to meat. That's a very common, called a gezeira. Okay?
Is that what you were saying?
Yeah.
To do with
Marat Ayin? That's Marat Ayin is an example of that. Yeah, that's correct. Thank you.